Thanks for downloading show 110 of the C-Suite podcast, the sixth in our special series of episodes that we're recording in partnership with the European PR agency Taito and their own Without Borders podcast, where we are interviewing leaders of unicorn companies to find out about the key issues, pain points and challenges that startups face and how they can address them with a strategic approach to marketing and communications. My name is Russell Goldsmith, and as regular listeners will know, I co-host these particular episodes with Taito's founder Brendan Craigie. And so joining us both online from Hamburg is Dr. Tim Sievers, a CEO and founder of Deposit Solutions, an open banking platform that, as reported in the Financial Times, reached unicorn status in September 2019 after securing a $55 million investment for a 4.9% stake from Deutsche Bank. So welcome to the show, Tim. Great to have you as part of this series. And actually, you're our first unicorn leader to join us from Germany. Do you want to start by giving us a quick overview of the business?
Yes, of course. Thanks. Okay, so with Deposit Solutions, we do open banking for deposits, right? So deposits obviously are simple savings products. It's about overnight accounts, fixed term deposits, and notice accounts. And for savers, deposits are an important product category for the financial services needs. That's just where you put your money, the excess cash that you want to save. And for banks, this is a really important funding source. 40% of European banks' balance sheets are funded in deposits. And what we bring to this product category is the ability for a customer to use products of different providers under his existing home bank relationship, or we call that the point of sale, the interface to the customer. Because the point of sale can implement our platform into its own offering and then give their own customers access to all these third-party provider products. And on the other hand, the product providers, they gain access through our platform to a huge additional addressable market for their funding. So it really is a win-win. And it's also called open architecture. It's something that's quite well known from other product categories. And we are really bringing this into the product category of savings.
Tim, I mentioned at the top of the show that Deposit Solutions achieved unicorn status towards the end of 2019. Did that milestone change the perception of your company at all?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, maybe so. I think in many ways it didn't change much. I guess it brought us maybe a little more attention, and it was maybe sort of comparable to when Peter Thiel invested. I was also surprised how that gave us some more credibility with parties that didn't know us before. And in our industry, so obviously as a fintech, and especially as a B2B focused fintech like us, we're selling to banks. Banks are very conservative organizations. Typically, they are much larger than us. They're always worried about whether they can trust a partner, whether the partner is going to be around for long enough, and all these things. So I think on that dimension, it may have helped us a little bit.
And how do you build a company culture in such a fast-moving and high-growth environment?
I mean, obviously, so this is a challenge, right? Because we are fast-growing, and that means many people who work with us today haven't been with the company for very long. And also it's an environment that is changing quite fast paced and demanding on the team also. And I think first thing is you've got to make sure that you find the right people who are looking for this, who are looking for what we are, eager to take responsibility. So that's sort of the sort of team building aspect of it. But then when everyone's there, I think you've also got to make sure to unite them behind a common goal. That's really a communication challenge. You've got to make sure everyone understands the vision so they can take the right decisions decentrally, even though they may not have been with the company for such a long time, right? And then also finally, what I've noticed is that it's not only important to say what behavior is wanted, it is also important to have a very clear code of conduct, like what isn't acceptable. And I think this is also something that one has to kind of find a consensus and build a consensus around. I mean, as you say, it's a challenge every day, but it's also exciting.
That's fantastic. One of the things that we've seen with quite a few of the unicorn CEOs that we've spoken to, Tim, is that they've usually been involved in other kind of companies before, in sort of creating and building other companies. And I believe you founded and sold a company that created intranet solutions for mid-sized companies. What sort of did you take away from that experience? And were there any mistakes you made along the way that you're kind of now learning from with Deposit Solutions?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, this was ages ago. So this was my early 20s. I had just finished university, and in the sort of late 90s, around the turn of the century, with dot-com bubble going on, I first joined the startup of a friend of mine, building up the German subsidiary of his startup. And then I founded my own company for the first time, and did that with a friend. And I mean, many things were different then. It was a different industry. I was, as I said, much younger. But I guess the two things that I took away from this was to focus on team and product. And I think that's what I've done this time around also. And I think that's important when you start up something new.
Yeah, no, so exciting building teams and kind of navigating all of that. And you kind of opened up, Tim, talking about obviously you're part of this big transformation that's going on in financial services around open banking. To anyone that's kind of maybe new to that subject area and what's going on, what is open banking and why do we need it?
Right. I think this is really important also because there is sort of some discussion and clarity sometimes around what exactly open banking is. And to me, open banking is about putting the customer at the center of everything. So the customer needs at the center of everything. It's not about pushing products onto a customer base off your own balance sheet. It's about really understanding what your customer wants and needs and adapting around that. And I think this, of course, includes the whole PSD2 world, which is especially in the UK, I think, the focus of discussion a lot. And that's rather recent. But it also means or contains the whole world of open architecture where we play in, which is actually a little older. In some product categories, this is already 20 or 30 years old. It's the principle of making available, on top of your own products, also third-party products to your own customer base. And the two together, PSD2 and open architecture, are really, I think, very powerful in transforming the industry to the benefit of the customer. And they also create huge opportunities for those industry players that embrace it, and especially the incumbents, I think. Of course, also, there are a lot of challenges, like new players in the industry. But especially for the incumbents, I believe open banking is a huge opportunity.
And I mean, maybe just kind of as a follow-up to that, you obviously have your consumer-facing brands, and then you obviously have a more of a B2B focus. What's the kind of thinking behind having those kind of two different dimensions to your business?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, our vision is to build an infrastructure for the deposits product category. And that is a B2B focused vision. And that's how I set out as well, like 10 years ago when I started the company. We spent about 3-4 years building the platform. And then when I went to present it to the first partners, trying to win them to participate, the distribution partners told me, look, come back when you've got products on the shelf. And the product providers told me, come back when you have distribution, right? So there was a giant chicken and egg problem to solve. And at that time, we started our own B2C point of sale, our own client, direct client-facing business. It runs under the brand of Zinspilot in Germany and Savedo in our international markets. And with that, we distribute the products listed on our platform directly to savers. And this was really useful because it proved to other market participants, you know, that this works, it's feasible, the regulator is fine with it, and customers want it. But it also meant that for product providers, I could say, look, here's the vision, we'll have lots of distribution for you, but regardless of what happens, I have this channel here which works already, and I can get you deposits tomorrow. So with that, we were able to build the product panel, and with that, we were able to win more point of sale partners. We have more than 100 today, and product providers from more than 20 European countries. But Zinspilot was, so the B2C platform was really helping us overcome the chicken and egg problem. It's putting it like that shows that we are all about B2B, but it kind of understates, I think, the relevance of Zinspilot, the B2C business, a little bit too, because it, I think even standalone, this has definitely been one of the most successful European B2C fintechs.
That's brilliant, yeah.
And is doing quite well today.
I can see how that's very compelling, being able to kind of have those, be able to kind of show it in action, as well as kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it also means that we can learn from the user experience and, you know, sort of optimize our product with direct insights. And so it has many sort of secondary advantages.
Yeah.
But what I just said about the chicken and egg problem, that's how it all started.
And you obviously get to expose to kind of the fintech ecosystem on a global level, but you know, around the world. Where are you most excited at the moment in terms of where are you seeing the greatest innovation coming out of, you know, which kind of fintech hubs, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really tough one. I think one thing that is interesting, I mean, there's lots of exciting stuff going on, right? Around sort of new regulation like PSD2, around payments and around loans and in the savings space and, you know, all these sort of new products and formats also that are tested on customers. So there's lots of exciting stuff. What I find interesting is that this is one area where, you know, it's not like the innovation is happening in the US and then the rest of the world follows. There is exciting stuff being invented in Europe as well as in the States. And in fact, there are quite a few European startups which are starting up businesses in the US now. We are one of them, as much as the other way around, right? So I think this is exciting. But also beyond Europe and the US, I think it's quite interesting also to see how, for instance, in Africa, they are sort of leapfrogging directly to mobile applications and sort of how behavior, customers haven't learned the desktop behavior so much, so they are more open to try new formats on the mobile. And there's sort of exciting stuff happening there as well. So I wouldn't be able to pick one winner, I guess.
Just picking up on what you just said there about launching into the US, how are those plans going?
Yeah, no, it's going well. So it's really far advanced as well, actually. I think this is sort of one of the projects that has been delayed by the corona crisis. We are looking to launch as soon as within this year, obviously depending a little bit on how the situation in the US evolves. It's something that we've been preparing for 2 years already. This has been a big challenge for us as a company. We want to make sure that, of course, we want to use our core strengths. At the same time, product market fit in Europe doesn't translate one-to-one into product market fit in the US. So we went to great lengths to actually make sure to adapt the product to the local requirements, not just in terms of regulation and sort of the contractual frameworks, but also in terms of the competitive landscape and customer needs. So we actually invested quite a bit of time and have a team in New York, which is they're all in home office, of course, too now. And we're currently preparing our market launch and sort of on the last mile to that.
It's really exciting. So you, if we're correct, you're up to about 300 employees now. And, you know, sticking with this kind of theme around communications, I think as a leader, you always have to kind of balance the need to communicate with individuals, but then also need to communicate with the team and kind of get your message across to, you know, to the entire company. How do you, as a leader, how do you navigate that? What's your kind of approach?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, there's obviously Corona changed that a little bit too, right? But I think generally I've found that it's good to be, so we've experimented with this and I find that sitting with the team helps just because there's sort of informal communication that is happening all the time. And sort of I also tried for some time like being in a separate office just by myself, which obviously when you're on the phone so much also has its advantages. But I think the other model, so we went back to that and I think that helps because there's lots of informal communication. But then also what we found over the years is especially coming back to what I said earlier about uniting a team behind one common goal and vision, you have to have some sort of organized, centralized formats of communication on top of the informal things that are going on. And obviously lots of that is happening, trickling down the sort of line management structures, like every leader with their teams. And then you kind of speak to the team leaders and so on. But also the, I think direct formats we have experimented with. And it's not always easy to make it like at the same time, you know, short enough for everyone to keep attention and sort of long enough to be able to provide sufficient substance. But we found this has become quite an effective format for us too. So I try to communicate directly to all as well as to the individual leaders or sort of individual people. And my colleagues in the management try to do that too. We also have now, I think what we've seen now in the Corona time, like where remote work and, you know, people are at home, what we've seen is that people tend to get on video calls, with the whole team several times a day. And what we've also seen is that we've found it's quite useful to provide also higher frequency of internal communication formats, like a newsletter, you know, sort of to still get across that you're part of, you know, you're part of one team, one community, even though everyone's sitting at home.
Has this period challenged you as a leader of the business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been really quite challenging. I think, yeah. Especially on the communication side, but also in other respects. While we are, I think, you know, lucky in many regards compared to other industries, this has still been hugely challenging for our clients and for us, and with delays in projects and teams in different places and, you know, all these things. So yes, this has been definitely a challenging time.
Yeah, I mean, we're actually recording this just as lockdown is starting to be eased. But when we were talking earlier, before we actually started the podcast, you were saying there's still only a few people in the office. And I think you said today it was around 15 or so. How much of an impact has the COVID-19 crisis had on your business as a whole?
Yeah, I think this has had an impact on everyone, I guess. And it's certainly had a big impact on us. We are in our fourth month of home office and remote work. We started really early, like the beginning of March. Fortunately, the team has done well so far, but it's affected us. I mean, it's affected how we work, for sure. It's also affected our business. I mean, we're in that sense, we're in a fortunate position because we're not in travel or like in the sort of restaurants business or whatever. I mean, some of the industries have been hit much harder. But also for us, it means that quite a few projects that we had planned to implement with partners in the second quarter had been delayed or even cancelled because the partners were busy with business continuity management and crisis management. So it means that this year we are growing slower than we had planned to grow. We will still grow. So I think we're still, I mean, we shouldn't complain too much. The demand for our services hasn't like broken down or anything, but it's definitely been a tough time for us.
Just thinking like a bit more broadly around the economy and the environment we're in at the moment, it always kind of slightly depresses me when I look at what interest rates I can get on my savings. And, you know, like it's kind of, I'm kind of like thinking, why do I bother when you literally can't get a return? And I'm just wondering, we see interest rates still seem to be going down. You know, you've got, I think, negative interest rates, I think, you know, the European Central Bank. How is this a viable business for banks at the moment to kind of be managing people's money for savings?
Yeah, it's a challenging time for everyone, for savers and for banks, I guess, right? As I said earlier, for banks, deposits are really important as a funding source. And this is like the recent turmoils in the sort of capital markets and the variations in the wholesale market funding costs for banks have brought home the importance of retail deposit funding, because that is, it's stable, it's granular, it doesn't run away in panic like when something like a crisis hits. So it's an important funding source for banks regardless of the interest rate level, and having access to it and a diversified pool of retail clients to tap into for your funding is of strategic importance and risk management importance regardless of the cost. But also for the savers, it increases the pressure, right? So when your home bank is giving you zero or threatening to give you a negative rate, that's, I mean, the other way to look at it, like one way to look at it is like, okay, why should I even bother? The other way to look at it is like, okay, where can I sort of make sure I'm not losing money? So we feel that demand, yes, from savers has not at all been going down with this decrease in rates over the past years. If anything, the problem of the saver has become bigger. And also the question is, what else to do, right? What else do you do? If you don't put it in the bank, at least it's deposit insured. You can be pretty sure, I mean, you will get back your money. You might not earn a large, huge interest, but you will get back your money. When you put it into stock markets, of course, in the long term, that's likely going to be giving you a good return. But then you have to have good nerves to sort of take those swings of 30% down and 50% up. And you know, what we're, yes, seeing like these past months. And also depends on what stage in your life you're in. I mean, if you're saving, that's fine. If you're in retirement, that's not great. I mean, the sort of you don't have, maybe you have the sort of 30 years until you want to get access to your money. So I think you don't want to put the cash under your sofa, right? I think that's, we see that there is a huge demand from banks and from savers, and it's pretty robust, and the market is huge. In Europe alone, it's more than 10,000 billion euros. So that's a pretty exciting, wow, market. And it seems very robust to any changes in the interest rate.
And do you think, like, just in terms of the threat of recession, or, you know, which we've seen recession called in different, you know, different economies already, Do you think that like defaults from consumers and businesses on loans, how will that kind of feed through to the sector?
So again, I think looking at both groups we're working with, the savers and the banks. So for banks, when they have defaults and default rates are increasing, it means that the swaps, the spreads are going to widen. So it means that funding is becoming more expensive for them when they try to get it in sort of wholesale markets or capital markets. This also means that, relatively speaking, deposit funding is going to be more attractive and more important, especially as maybe some banks worry about rating decreases or things like that. In the deposit market, everything's deposit insured, at least up to a cap of 100,000 euros, which is sort of, well, the average is at 40,000 euros per saver. So savers don't need to worry about counterparty risks. So this is something, this is a really important funding source that doesn't dry up in a crisis. So I think from the bank's perspective, if anything, a recession is going to make deposits more important and more attractive. From the saver side, of course, people in a recession might have less to save, but then also typically stock markets aren't doing so great. So this all comes back to deposits just being a very robust market, partly because it's so huge and partly because it's the default of what you do with your money.
Tim, I want to bring this conversation back to communications. It's a key part of what we've been speaking to all our unicorn leaders in each of these episodes. And what we look at is, as we talked about earlier, is that journey to becoming a unicorn. As a tech startup where you're based in Europe rather than Silicon Valley, what's been your approach to raising awareness and also differentiating yourself in such a noisy and crowded area?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So I have to say, like in the first couple of years, I didn't spend much time on communications at all. I think we were very product focused and sort of focused on building the team. And I think it's probably something that with hindsight, we maybe could have started to do a little earlier. So we weren't at all happening in the whole sort of founder press and in this, you know, sort of pretty much focus on just getting the right product out and obviously speaking to our clients, getting the product market fit. And this has led to, for the first couple of years, people were typically surprised, firstly, that, you know, or asking, wondering who we are, and then secondly, surprised that we were perceived to be smaller than we were most of the time. I think what we have done over the years then is that we have increased our attention to communications, firstly by contributing to the debate around topics that are relevant for us. So we've got a sort of thought leadership program where we sort of commission research around our area of expertise around deposits and bank funding and all these things. We participate in industry conferences and have an event series where we invite industry players and sort of present on different topics, both sort of our internal know-how, but also have external speakers. So we've actually, today we're doing much more than in the past. But I think in the early years, we've been rather inward oriented. I think today we're still not the loudest in the room, but you don't have to always be. I mean, after all, we are pretty B2B focused and we've got to sort of convince with our products.
And how do you view your role as an external spokesperson and representative of the business? And, you know, what have you learned along the way?
Yeah, this comes back a little to what I said earlier. I think you shouldn't be too loud too early. We have been criticized sometimes for being for not happening externally, sort of, or being hard to, sort of not getting enough attention. But I think it's also good to not be too loud too early, because it helps build credibility. And then if your product is too far behind the narrative, that usually catches up with you also in sales. So that's not good either. I think what we have been trying to do is contribute to the industry debate with our sort of research pieces. We have also tried to contribute to the debate by participating in sort of different committees. For instance, in a committee of the German Finance Ministry on different sort of fintech related questions, together with industry leaders from the sort of established banks and sort of similar formats. And we're also participating in a sort of workshop series of the German Banking Association, and you know, in the countries we are in, we sometimes also sort of try to get involved with either sponsoring industry events or participating in roundtables and things like that. So I think there is this sort of participation, which I think is important for us, also in terms of shaping our, like, the space we are active in. I mean, we have many challenges, like the, for instance, the European single market, which is more a, which just isn't, sounds great, but in practice is just so far from where we need to be that I think there's a lot of work required by everyone active in this industry, and it's affecting us fintechs in particular, especially the ones that are looking for international markets. And yeah, I mean, this is sort of, I guess, this has sort of been our focus.
And what about you personally? Have you always been a natural communicator, or have you, you know, had to work on it and formulate a plan? Because quite often when someone has an idea and launches a business, they want to be behind the scenes and getting it, building it, and not necessarily be at the front, you know, end of that business. Has it been a natural thing for you to be a communicator for the business?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's been a development for me too. When we started off, I wasn't used to sort of giving speeches or presenting to large audiences. So this is something you sort of pick up with practice along the way, I guess. And I think that's sort of comes sort of with the job. On the interpersonal side also, I don't know whether I mentioned this, but we are quite an international team. We have, I think, the 300 people are from 44 nationalities. So lots of, when collaborating, there are these sort of cultural aspects around communication too. And I'm Northern German, so I tend to be pretty direct, right? So I think this has also been a journey for me to sort of try and adapt and make my points, but maybe also work a little bit on the style to be more compatible for people from other cultural backgrounds.
Who are the least direct, do you think?
Least direct? Oh, that's a hard one. I think I wouldn't say least direct, but there are sort of more elegant ways of saying no, for instance, in India than there are in Northern Germany.
right, okay. That's interesting. Excellent. That is a very, very nicely put.
Actually, sorry, Brenda, just in terms of with your communication across the business then, what do you use English across the business as a consistent language, or is it
yeah.
German? Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so about 3 years after I started the company, we realized that it was hard to find the people we need in the local labor market. So we switched the company language to English and then just started hiring internationally.
Interesting.
And thinking about your career so far, Tim, what has been your biggest communications challenge that you faced?
I think the corona crisis has been the biggest challenge in many dimensions, but also in communications. It's been difficult because you have to be straight and honest with the team and I guess the people you're talking to. And so, you know, you can't pretend like everything's fine. At the same time, you want to make sure to also provide context and calibrate it correctly. And, you know, there's no need for panic. And it's been a challenge to find the balance doing that right. Also, obviously, through new formats, because you can't just sort of get everyone together or maybe have, you know, sort of walk through the rooms and sort of have a chat with everyone or sort of present to individual teams or so, which is all sort of stuff that we've done in the past when we were all in the office, but you had to do it all remotely as well. So this has been a communications challenge.
Yeah, no, undoubtedly. And thinking about communications again, what's the kind of best piece of advice that anyone's ever given you? Anything that's stuck with you that's been passed on?
So I guess sort of an important piece of advice would have been to stay authentic. It's I think something that people notice when you're not authentic. So I think you've got to stay close to who you are and then sort of work with what you've got.
Yeah, I think that's good advice.
Tim, thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We've got one final question for you, which we've been asking all our unicorn leaders. And it's, if you were to go back in time and speak to your old self, what guidance would you give about communications and what steps would you encourage yourself to take in order for you and the business to excel in communications?
Okay, so I think I would actually, I've challenged myself on this before. So I think I would stick with focusing on product and team in the early years, but then probably we should have switched earlier. We should have started to contribute to the wider industry context around our expertise earlier. This has proven to be really effective for us. It's been a good instrument for us to reach our audience, our target groups. And I think that, I guess this is sort of, we are having good success with it now. I think this is something we could have started 5 years ago.
Tremendous. Thank you so much for doing that today, Dr. Tim Sievers. Cheers for joining the podcast, and good luck with the launch in the US, hopefully soon.
Good luck, Tim.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. Take care.
So, Brendan, that's unicorn leader number 6 in the can. Thoughts on what Tim had to say today?
I mean, it was great learning about their business and kind of the chicken and egg point that Tim mentioned about how they kind of built their own consumer platform to demonstrate the value of the business. And then I think probably picking up on the theme of communications, the thing that struck me is that kind of that reflection Tim had on the need to actually be out there engaging with the industry and contributing, and then perhaps in hindsight, you know, they should have done that earlier, but they're now doing. I think that's kind of maybe an important learning that other CEOs might benefit from.
Yeah, and one thing I picked up, because bearing in mind this whole series is about European unicorns, the fact that he said he's got 44 nationalities in the business, I mean, that is a challenge that they're not necessarily going to get if you're starting up in the States, as we talked about, is it?
Yeah, no, that is a huge challenge. And yeah, it was interesting to just hear that how they made that decision to, you know, make English the dominant language after 3 years. And but it sounds like yeah, they've got some great approaches in place to manage all of that communication.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look forward to, as I said, seeing their growth in the US very soon. Well, that is actually it for this 6th episode in this special series that we're producing with Taito. If you want to find out more about Deposit Solutions, their website is simply deposit-solutions.com. We'd also love to hear your comments on today's chat, and you can share them on our Facebook page, LinkedIn, Instagram and Twitter feeds. And those are all linked from the top of the website at csuitepodcast.com, where you'll also find all our previous shows and supporting shows notes, plus links to where you can subscribe for automatic downloads of each episode via the likes of Spotify and Apple. And if you've liked what you've heard, please do give us a positive rating and review. We're of course available on all podcast apps. Just search for the C-Suite podcast and hit subscribe. You can also subscribe to the Without Borders podcast from our partners at Taito, and all the details for that are on their website. So just head to taitopr.com, click on the podcast link in the top navbar, and you should find it there. If you are a unicorn leader yourself and you'd like to be part of this series, please do get in touch with us via the contact form on the website at csuitepodcast.com. Plus, of course, anyone can get in touch with the show via that same process to share any feedback you may have. Finally, you can also reach me via Twitter using @RossGoldsmith, or you can find me on LinkedIn. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.